Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone. It is Tuesday, the 12th day of November in the year 2024, and I thank you for joining me today for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglewitz, and as always, I'll be reading from today's edition of the paper, along with related stories that may have come to us in the previous few days. We'll begin with several stories that are a follow-up to last week's national election. The first of these is titled, Trump's Day One Promises Are Ambitious and Controversial. This story comes to us from Washington, D.C., and is submitted by staff writer Linda Feldman. Donald Trump's 2024 campaign promises were sweeping, delivered with bravado. On day one alone, then-candidate Trump pledged to begin mass deportations, pardon January 6 rioters, start dismantling the quote-unquote deep state, end the Green New Deal, cut federal funding for schools pushing radical gender ideology, and drill, baby, drill, shorthand for increasing production of fossil fuels. President-elect Trump won't be a dictator except on day one, he famously said last year. Over the decades, American presidents have wielded expanding power up front by signing stacks of executive orders. President Joe Biden signed a record 42 such orders in his first 100 days, many of them undoing the policies of Mr. Trump, his predecessor. Now, with the former president returning to office in January after a sweeping election victory, his pen is ready. Executive power has its limits, and civil liberties groups will be watching Mr. Trump's actions closely. There will be lawsuits, which could tie up some orders in court. Some orders, too, are likely to require congressional action. Still, expect day one and the 99 days that follow to be bracing. During the campaign, Mr. Trump spoke of going after political opponents, be it unnamed radical leftists or named Democratic leaders whom he has called, quote, the enemy from within, unquote. Last week, informal Trump advisors and richest man in the world, Elon Musk, said on X that special counsel Jack Smith's, quote, abuse of the justice system cannot go unpunished, unquote. He was referring to the two federal cases brought against the former president, one for allegedly mishandling classified documents, and the other for allegedly plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss. Mr. Smith is already putting the two federal cases against Mr. Trump on hold. On Sunday, Trump surrogates sought to cool the temperature around fears of retribution. There's no enemies list, Florida GOP Representative Byron Donald said on Fox News on Sunday. We're the party who are against going after your opponents using lawfare, House Judiciary Committee Chair Jim Jordan then added. On CNN, referring to the federal and state prosecutions of Mr. Trump that are now expected to disappear. Mr. Trump is likely to focus initially on his domestic policy agenda. Exit polls showed the economy and immigration topping voter concerns, and those are policy areas where Mr. Trump appears eager to show quick results. Sunday night, the president-elect announced that Tom Homan, former acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director, will serve as quote-unquote border czar, in charge of the boundaries with Mexico and Canada, as well as U.S. airspace and coastline. Mr. Homan's position does not require Senate confirmation. He stepped down from the first Trump administration after his brash style hindered his confirmation. Also on tap to fill a senior White House role is longtime Trump aide Stephen Miller, a well-known hardliner on immigration. Multiple outlets have reported that Mr. Miller will be Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, a title that is likely to understate his influence. Vice President-elect J.D. Vance posted his congratulations on X. Earlier, Mr. Trump named his campaign manager, Susie Wiles, as White House Chief of Staff. Ms. Wiles will be the first woman to hold that position and is a highly regarded political strategist, but has never worked in government. Mr. Trump is said to respect Ms. Wiles in a way that he didn't respect the four people who cycled through that post in his first term. Part of her job will be to instill order in the Oval Office, preventing people from coming and going at will, something that didn't happen in the first Trump term. But it's unclear that she'll be able to steer Mr. Trump away from doing things that may be ill-advised or unconstitutional. Has he found somebody who can rattle the cage and say, "Look, you can't do this, it will hurt the country, it's wasteful," says Paul Light, an expert on governance at New York University. He has his doubts. The most disruptive initiative in Trump's 2.0 might be his plan to shut down the U.S.-Mexico border on day one and launch the biggest deportation of unauthorized migrants in U.S. history. Initial plans reportedly include a declaration of national emergency that would allow use of Pentagon funds to pay for the effort, including detention on military bases and deportation costs. The operation could target up to 20 million people, according to the Trump team, with a goal of deporting 1 million people a year. The plan is to focus first on migrants who have committed crimes beyond entering the U.S. illegally, or who pose a national security threat. But in an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes last month, Mr. Homan made clear that the deportation initiative wouldn't end there. "It will be targeted arrests," Mr. Homan said, "not mass sweeps of neighborhoods." But when asked about a return of the family separations of the first Trump term, he didn't rule it out. An undocumented migrant who has a child in the U.S. has created that crisis, he said. The initiative would require a significant increase in trained personnel and, according to the Liberal American Immigration Council, could cost tens of billions of dollars a year. It could also have a significant impact on the economy as workers in service industries and agriculture are detained and expelled. But the Trump transition team says the election gives him a mandate to act. On the energy front, Mr. Trump's plan to drill, baby, drill aims to cut consumer costs. He's expected to pull out again from the Paris Agreement on climate change, ease regulations on greenhouse gas emissions, and end a pause on permits for liquefied natural gas export projects. What the Trump team doesn't point out is that Mr. Biden presided over record levels of U.S. oil production as his administration approved new drilling permits. but Mr. Biden restricted drilling on public lands, a policy Mr. Trump is expected to reverse. I will terminate the Green New Scam and will cut your energy prices in half, 50%, within 1 year from January 20, Mr. Trump said at his October 27th rally in Madison Square Garden. Another day one priority is likely to be a revival of his Schedule F initiative. The measure, launched late in his first term and rescinded immediately by President Biden, would remove the job security of some 50,000 civil servants, allowing for them to be fired at will. Mr. Trump has long claimed that the quote-unquote deep state undermined his agenda during his first term. The Conservative Heritage Foundation has made the revival of Schedule F part of its Project 2025 initiative to help the incoming Trump administration, including a list of vetted replacements for fired civil servants. Mr. Trump has distanced himself from the controversial program, but observers still expect some aspects, including Schedule F, to be implemented. Now we turn to a related story that comes to us from a number of Monitor correspondents and a number of countries, ranging from Johannesburg, South Africa, to Switzerland and China. And this article is titled, Trump is Back, Parents Worldwide Hope and Fear for Children's Futures. On Wednesday, November 6, Donald Trump declared victory in the U.S. presidential election. And in a tent camp for migrants in Mexico City, a Venezuelan boy named Yorjan turned 7 years old. Neither knew of the other's special day, but Mr. Trump's victory means their lives are now intertwined. Yorjan and his family are trying to cross the U.S. border, the same one the president-elect has promised to, quote, seal when he takes office in January. Yorjan was blissfully unaware of that pledge as he excitedly accepted a wedge of vanilla birthday cake laced with icing squiggles from a volunteer. But sitting beside him was his mother, Yojani, whose eyes pricked with tears. So much from the economic collapse that caused them to flee Venezuela to the rats scurrying through their tent felt out of her control as a mother. And now this. My fear now is that the U.S. president won't receive us, she says, that Trump will send us back to the jungle. Every 4 years, Americans choose who will fill the world's most powerful office. And this year, they've selected a leader who touts as one of his greatest foreign policy strengths his unpredictability. At a time of broad global conflict, with mass human migration, major wars in the Middle East and Europe, and China jockeying to surpass the United States as the world's superpower, Mr. Trump's America First mantra will bend the arc of the world's future. Political leaders and foreign diplomats are on alert. But this week, it was parents around the world who absorbed the news of Mr. Trump's victory with particular immediacy. Some feel that an American strongman could finally put an end to the instability that has shadowed their children's prospects. Others feel his erratic approach to global affairs has the potential to upend their dreams. Sometimes you pay for the problems that aren't yours, says Yojani, whose last name we are withholding for her security. As the sun dipped below the horizon on American Election Day, casting long shadows over a tent camp in central Gaza, Sausan Swirky's heart broke again. She wasn't thinking of Mr. Trump or Democratic candidate Kamala Harris, but of Musa. 1 year to the day earlier, her 16-year-old son had walked out of the gates of Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City, where the family was sheltering from Israeli airstrikes. In his hurry to get to safety, Musa left his beloved rescue cat, Mishmish, at home. Now, as the bombs fell and the sirens wailed, he couldn't bear the thought of Mishmish, scared and alone, looking for his master in the rubble, so Musa and his cousin decided to go back to find him. The bomb struck them on their way. Onlookers carried the severely wounded boy back to the hospital, where he died in front of his mother's eyes. Now, she says, I die 100 times a day. But as she listened to news about the American election results, a single hope pushed its way through her grief. Maybe Mr. Trump could end the war that has killed so far at least 42,000 Palestinians. I wish he would bring a ceasefire. That would allow Palestinians to return home, she says. She knew that plenty of people thought it was possible. Mr. Trump had told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he wanted a quote, end to hostilities before his inauguration day, according to Israeli media. Far from those backroom negotiations, Ms. Swirky was simply desperate to keep her family alive. She longed to see one of her daughters, who lived on the other side of an Israeli checkpoint, and every day she feared another of her 9 children might die doing something ordinary like collecting water. Waiting for Mr. Trump's next move, she revisited her memories of Musa, the boy who loved okra with beef, had an incredible laugh, and died for the love of an innocent. In her grief, she hoped only that the next American president would make sure that, quote, no parent in the world sees what I have seen, unquote. 396 days. That was how long it had been, on American Election Day, since the last time Edith Ohel had seen her son, Alon. That October evening, he sat at the family piano in a village in northern Israel, his fingers gliding across the keyboard as he played a popular Israeli song about longing. Nothing suggested it was the eve of the family's greatest nightmare. But early on the next morning, on October 7th, 2023, Hamas militants stormed the Nova Music Festival, where Alon, 22 years old and an aspiring jazz pianist, had gone with friends. They dragged him by his curly hair, tossing him into a pickup truck with others he had been sheltering with, and drove them into Gaza. Since then, Miss O'Hill's life has been consumed by a single thought. Alon must live. And for Alon to live, the war must end. By American Election Day, her son had become a familiar face to Israelis, his image plastered on posters across the country, along with others taken captive that day and carried through the streets in mass protests. The Israeli government's failure to return him and other hostages wasn't just a reminder of the country's most catastrophic intelligence failure or the war it had sparked. It was also a challenge to a fundamental covenant of the Israeli society. Leave no one behind. Miss O'Hell never had much interest in politics, seeing herself as merely a person interested in doing good in the world, she says. But now she had no choice but to care, because her child's life depended on the choices of politicians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remained steely in his resolve to fight in Gaza until what he calls, quote, total victory. But like Ms. Swerky, Ms. O'Hell saw hope in Mr. Trump, though it was a faint one. He wasn't a man who took no for an answer. He projected aggression and power. He says he wants to make peace here, she says, her voice soft and exhausted. Maybe, she thought, that would be enough to finally bring Alon home. Marina also knows what it's like to live in the unspeakable space between your child's life and their death. In March 2022, her son, Volodya, abruptly stopped calling. At the time, he was a junior intelligence officer serving in the Russian army in the Russian-occupied Donbas region of Ukraine. When she stopped hearing from him, Marina, a real estate agent, whom we are calling by a pseudonym for her security, first approached the local military office. It didn't have an answer, so she went to Moscow, and then to Donbas itself. There, she traveled from town to town with a photo of Volodya, clean-shaven and baby-faced, barely out of his teens, asking every soldier she met if they had seen him. Each no ached, but it also gave her hope that he was still out there somewhere, perhaps captured by the Ukrainians, but still breathing. Then, in early 2024, she received a notification from the army. Volodya's remains had been identified. He died a hero, she was told, but the platitudes felt hollow. This hell is over for me now, but so many other mothers are still going through it, Marina says. On the campaign trail, Mr. Trump pledged repeatedly that as president, he would end Marina's war in, quote, 24 hours. Julia Kozak wants her war to end, too. The Ukrainian mother was 7 months pregnant when Russia invaded her country. She was on vacation at that time, and her flight home was canceled. So she flew to Zurich, where she had a friend who could give her a place to stay. Today, her daughter, Dana, is growing up like any other Swiss suburban child, in Basel now, splashing around in toddler swim classes and speaking to her mother in a babbling mix of English and Ukrainian. Ms. Kozak is grateful Dana's first memories won't be of hearing air raid sirens and hiding in basements. But she also cannot help but long for the life they do not have. Just before she left Kyiv, she had bought an apartment there, where she imagined she would raise her daughter in comfort, surrounded by friends and family, not as a refugee in a foreign land. Watching the American election results this week, she felt conflicted. While she likes the Democrats, they were unable to stop the war or help Ukraine win it. Mr. Trump strikes her as a, quote, crazy person, but his unusual methods might just be her country's best hope now. He wants to be a hero, and if he does stop the Ukraine war, then he will be a hero. Marina, who this spring held Volodya's funeral in the same church where she had brought him to be baptized two decades earlier, is silent when asked if the American president-elect can usher in peace. Finally, she says, quote, I've always believed that everybody needs to sit down at the negotiating table and put a stop to this slaughter. If this Trump can do that, I will support it. Indeed, Mr. Trump promised in his victory speeches that he would make the world a more peaceful place. "I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop the wars," he proclaimed. Those words brought comfort to Li Jiandong. Though he has never lived through the war himself, he too knows its costs. Like other Chinese of his generation, the 44-year-old music teacher was raised by relatives who had survived two violent conflicts: the Japanese occupation around World War II, and then the Chinese Civil War just after it. His grandfather barely eked out a living from tiny terraced fields in the drought and famine-prone hills of China's northwest Shanxi province. His parents, meanwhile, grew up in the turbulent aftermath of the 1949 Communist Revolution, hunger and political unrest hanging low over their childhoods, too. By contrast, Mr. Li was born at a moment when China was stabilizing and flinging itself open to the world. That allowed him to study music education at secondary school, a level of learning his parents could not have dreamed of. His own children have done even better. His eldest son is now 20 and a university student in a technical field. Lately, however, the peace that made all this possible has begun to feel precarious to Mr. Li. Amid growing U.S.-China tensions, the Chinese military was stepping up operations around Taiwan, the self-governing island of 23 million people across the Taiwan Strait that Beijing claims sovereignty over. A war for Taiwan would ensnare the U.S. too, and so much depended on the American president-elect, a man who often seemed to despise China, but also promised geopolitical pragmatism. "That is the best," Mr. Li says. If there was one thing he knew intimately, after all, it was how much depended on peace. In Mexico City, Yojani spent much of Yorjan's birthday listening to post-election rumors whistle through the migrant camp at warp speed. People spoke of mass deportations, of the border closing. Yojani didn't know what was true, but she was shaken. In July, she and her husband made the painful choice to leave home so that her children could have a future, she says. They made a journey she would never wish on any child, walking hungry through jungles that echoed with the howls of wild animals, to end up here. And now it felt like it was all at risk. As she spoke, Yorjan reappeared, rosy-cheeked with damp hair, after a shower he cheerfully described as freezing cold. He wore a new hoodie plucked from a table of donated clothes. He had chosen the red, white, and blue uniform of Captain America. And it should be noted that special correspondent Taylor Luck contributed to this report. And an editor's note, a caption in this story, which was originally published on November 8th, has been updated to clarify the name of the authorities with whom migrants seeking entry into the U.S. meet. Now we turn to an article that comes to us from Washington, D.C., submitted by Cameron Joseph, staff writer, last Friday. And his article is titled, "Democrats Begin Soul-Searching and Finger-Pointing After Devastating Loss." It's the inflation, stupid. As divided and demoralized Democrats sift through the ashes of the 2024 election map, most agree on 2 points. Vice President Kamala Harris was fighting strong headwinds when it came to how voters felt about the cost of living. And her inability to convince enough voters that she could do a better job than Donald Trump on the economy cost her the election. Two-thirds of voters rated the economy poorly, according to exit polls. President-elect Trump won them 70% to 28%. Nearly half of all voters said that their family's financial situation was worse today than 4 years ago, and they backed Mr. Trump 81% to 17%. And less well-off voters were even more likely to swing to Mr. Trump. In 2020, he lost voters who made less than $50,000 a year by 10 points. This year, according to exit polls, he lost them by just 1 point. He lost voters who make between $50,000 and $100,000 by 15 points in 2020 and won them this election. The only group that moved toward Ms. Harris were voters who make six-figure incomes. She won them by 5 points this year after President Joe Biden lost them by 12 points in 2020. Democrats are uniformly alarmed that working-class voters who once made up the core of the Democratic base continued to abandon the party in droves. But they don't agree on why that happened, with some pointing to a failure to focus enough on pocketbook issues and, quote, soaking the rich, while others slammed tin-eared and sometimes condescending messages from professional class dominated by white college graduates. Working-class voters vote more on their perceived economic self-interest than abstract debates over things like democracy, says Jeff Hauser, a Democratic strategist and former spokesperson for the AFL-CIO, the largest union federation in the United States. Unfortunately, Democrats ran a campaign that in their national message was predominantly about abstract concerns like democracy and less about the solid economy. The big disagreement among Democrats isn't about the national headwinds. It's whether Ms. Harris and the party could have made major strategic decisions in the race's closing months to prevail anyway. Some are griping that the party didn't message effectively enough on the economy and took for granted Hispanic voters until it was too late. They are also debating whether they fundamentally have too many college-educated, liberal white people who come off as insincere when talking to blue-collar voters of all ethnic backgrounds. I think we've done a lot to demonstrate that we're a party largely of white elites, says Democratic strategist Andy Barr, who pointed to issues like student loan forgiveness as a way to alienate blue-collar voters. Most people in this country don't go to college, and we sort of act as if they do. Most Latinos in this country aren't fixated on immigration policy, and we sort of act as if they were, he says. We're running campaigns that sort of serve us and our interests, and not the people we say we're running to represent, unquote. One former Biden White House strategist who asked that they not be named in order to speak candidly said the party needs to do some deep soul searching about why Latinos and working class voters of all stripes decided that Mr. Trump was their best bet economically. Democrats are going to need to take some time to analyze, to rethink the way we engage voters and talk about policies and talk about our accomplishments, they said. The party does not need to tackle that issue head on. It's probably the most important. I'm sorry, I misstated that. The party does need to tackle that issue head on. It's probably the most important thing for the rebirth of the Democratic Party. Democrats may simply have forgotten Maslow's hierarchy of needs. People prioritize basic needs first. Finances, stability, safety, and subordinate everything else if those primary issues aren't addressed. Inflation, illegal immigration, and crime, all of which spiked in the first few years of the Biden-Harris administration coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, before dipping over the past year, were more salient and immediate to many voters than issues like protecting democracy or abortion access. Nearly one-third of voters who believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases voted for Trump. Mr. Trump even won some voters who admitted they didn't like him and worried about his policy views. By a 10-point margin, voters said he's, quote, too extreme, while a narrow majority of voters said Ms. Harris wasn't. Of the 53% of voters who hold an unfavorable view of him, 9% voted for him anyway. The unemployment rate is hovering at historic lows, and the stock market has boomed. But rent and groceries are still expensive, and that hurts a lot more for voters with limited means. Some leading figures on the left are now saying Democrats lost because they didn't do enough to fix it. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said in a post-election statement. First, it was the white working class, and now it's Latino and black workers as well. While the Democratic leadership defends the status quo, the American people are angry and they want change, and they're right, unquote. But around the globe, voters have punished incumbent parties on the left, right, and center for inflation, which was fueled by pandemic-driven supply chain interruptions and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as well as massive government spending that many countries undertook to keep their economies afloat during the depths of the COVID-19 shutdown and its aftermath. A Financial Times analysis found that in all 10 developed countries that have held elections this year, the governing party did worse than in the previous race. The first time this has ever happened. In fact, Democrats saw their vote share drop by a smaller amount than other ruling parties. Still, U.S. voters clearly weren't happy with the state of things. A majority, 59%, disapproved of Mr. Biden, including 45% who strongly disapproved. Ms. Harris, as his vice president, had an albatross around her neck the whole campaign. One challenge was that many of Democrats' economic achievements were tucked into sprawling packages with benefits that were only going to emerge in the long run or were already being phased out. The bipartisan infrastructure bill is just getting shovel-ready projects going. The Biden administration passed a hard cap on out-of-pocket Medicare spending, which will save money for a lot of older adults, but it doesn't kick in until 2025. the $3,600 child tax credits that were included in their 2021 pandemic relief package helped pull millions of children out of poverty, but it expired after 1 year, which left families feeling, rightly, like they suddenly had less money now. Even President Biden acknowledged that on Thursday, saying the, quote, vast majority of the good economic work his administration had done for the economy won't be felt for years, with policies and projects only now just really kicking in. And even if there were an economic record to sell, many Democrats gripe that they didn't have a candidate who could sell it for the past few years. As President Biden became more visibly frail, his staff limited his public appearances, turning down even traditional layups like the pre-Super Bowl interview. His disastrous June debate eventually forced him out of the race, leaving Ms. Harris just 107 days to build a presidential campaign and define herself to voters. David Plouffe, Ms. Harris's top advisor, posted on the social media platform X that the campaign had, quote, dug out of a deep hole, an implicit criticism of Mr. Biden. There are some signs that the Harris campaign's ad messaging and ground game actually did make a difference, even though it wasn't enough. She lost far less ground compared with in the 2020 election in the swing states where she campaigned than she did in the rest of the country. Milwaukee County, which includes the city and some inner suburbs, was the rare place where Mr. Trump only improved on his 2020 margins by 1 point. Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, where Charlotte is, moved just 2 points to the right, as did Fulton County, Georgia, which includes much of Atlanta. But the shift toward Mr. Trump was much more dramatic in some major metro areas than the campaigns didn't seriously contest. Miami-Dade County moved 19 points toward Mr. Trump, who became the first Republican presidential candidate to carry it since 1988. In New York City, where most of the vote has been counted as of Thursday, Ms. Harris was winning by a 38-point margin, down from Mr. Biden's 54-point margin 4 years ago. Cook County, Illinois, where Chicago is located, shifted 11 points toward Mr. Trump. Some of Ms. Harris's approach had similar problems as Mr. Biden's. Her pledge to incentivize home builders to increase housing supply, for instance, was long-term and abstract and wouldn't do anything for people whose rent has spiked in recent years. And some Democrats expressed frustration that her campaign had not stuck with populist messaging that Mr. Trump was a lackey for big business. She spent much of the end of the race focused on Mr. Trump as a threat to democracy, including in her closing argument speech on the National Mall. Mr. Trump's economic messaging seemed to be particularly successful with Hispanic voters. Exit polls showed Mr. Trump carrying 45% of the Hispanic vote nationally, a 13-point jump from his 2020 performance and the high water mark for any Republican presidential candidate in more than a half a century. The only other Republican who has topped 40% of the Hispanic vote since the TV networks began conducting exit polls in 1972 was George W. Bush in 2004. It's impossible to know how this race would have played out if Mr. Biden had decided not to run after the 2022 midterms, and if he had allowed Democrats to hold a primary for the nomination. Few Democrats would have struggled as much to get distance from the Biden administration as his number two. On the other hand, a primary could have led to a repeat of the 2019 contest, in which Democratic candidates were forced to the left on a bevy of issues by activist groups, and where some of Ms. Harris's most damaging comments, which were later resurrected in attack ads by the Trump campaign, were made. The Trump campaign spent the most money on an ad showing a clip of Ms. Harris promising to provide incarcerated transgender people access to gender-affirming care treatments. Democrats acknowledged that ad, and a follow-up ad featuring popular black radio host Charlemagne the God slamming her for the comments on his show did serious damage to her, convincing some swing voters that she was, quote, dangerously liberal, unquote, as the ad said. According to an analysis shared by Ms. Harris' leading super PAC with the New York Times, that spot shifted the race 2.7 percentage points toward Mr. Trump after viewers watched it. The tagline, quote, Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you, unquote, emphasized that she was focused on the wrong issues. While Mr. Trump appeared on scores of podcasts with large audiences of young men, Ms. Harris largely avoided them. Multiple Democrats faulted Ms. Harris for not accepting popular podcast host Joe Rogan's invitation to come to his Austin, Texas studio for an interview. Mr. Rogan, who leans right but holds fairly heterodox political views, interviewed Mr. Trump and endorsed him on the election's eve. Democrats don't all agree on what went wrong and whether Ms. Harris really stood a chance at fixing things, but they all agree that something needs to change. There are a lot of folks that look at how Democrats are portrayed and say they care about all these other things, but they don't care about what's going on in my life, says Democratic strategist Rodel Molyneux. There's a large chasm between what Democrats in Washington, D.C. think they are and what they stand for and what the American people perceive them to be and what they stand for, and that's what we have to address. Our next article comes to us from staff writer Stephanie Haynes, and her story is titled, A Lesson of Election 2024, There Is No Climate Voter. For people who rank climate change high on their list of societal concerns, the November 5th election result was a sobering one. The next U.S. president will be someone who campaigned on relying more on fossil fuels, not less. That result may seem counterintuitive, given that most Americans see climate change as a threat and believe human actions are the cause of it. But it's also not surprising, say many who study the issue. Multiple studies have shown that most voters rank climate or energy policy well below economic concerns and other social issues when it comes to picking political candidates. This election proved that there is no climate voter, says Roger Pielke Jr., a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder and a non-resident senior fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, who has long written about climate change and policy. He and political scientist Roy Teixeira another American Enterprise Institute fellow, conducted a survey of voters in September and found that even those who list climate as an important issue are generally unwilling to pay extra for it. It is important, says Dr. Pielke, of voter opinions on climate change. It's up there, but it's nowhere near immigration, inflation, the economy, and things like that. Climate and clean energy are important priorities, he says, but putting them into the context of economic prosperity is a far more effective approach than putting the climate goals at the forefront. To some extent, the nation's transition toward cleaner energy sources is already resting on a financial rationale that goes beyond the goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Solar and wind power are economically competitive with fossil fuels. If climate advocates are reeling from the election of Mr. Trump to a second term, many also hope that the country's transition toward clean energy has become economically powerful enough to withstand a change in political power. Indeed, the economic and energy landscape Mr. Trump is inheriting in 2024 is fundamentally different than it was in 2016, many experts say. The past 8 years has seen a dramatic expansion in both solar power and other renewable technologies, as well as a growing recognition among automakers and other manufacturers that if the U.S. does not make big gains in green technology, the country will find itself losing even more market share to China. There should be nothing partisan or political about creating jobs or driving economic growth or making our air and our water a little cleaner for all of us, says Bob Keefe, the executive director of E2, a nonpartisan group of business leaders advocating for a clean economy. Still, throughout the campaign, Mr. Trump criticized the climate policies of the Biden administration, particularly incentives for electric vehicles. His promises of drill, baby, drill reflects his goal of ramping up oil and gas production, even more so than the record levels under the Biden administration. He has also pledged to roll back clean power regulations. Perhaps most influentially, Mr. Trump has talked about repealing the $437 billion Inflation Reduction Act, which he has blamed for inflation and described as the, quote, Green New Scam, unquote. But the realities of what he can or will want to do with that legislation is complicated. More than 80% of the clean energy investments catalyzed by the IRA into everything from new battery or electric vehicle factories to green cement projects or solar plants has gone to Republican districts. In August, a group of 18 GOP representatives sent a letter to Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, urging him to, quote, prioritize business and market certainty as you consider efforts that repeal or reform the Inflation Reduction Act, unquote. While the group criticized the partisan passage of what it called a deeply flawed bill, the representatives also pointed out that energy tax credits have spurred innovation, incentivized investment, and created good jobs in many parts of the country, including many districts represented by members of our conference. As Republicans, we support an all-of-the-above approach to energy development and tax credits that incentivize domestic production, innovation, and delivery from all sources, unquote. Businesses, meanwhile, want a stable regulatory environment, says Ann Kelly, Vice President for Government Relations at Ceres, a nonprofit and business network working on clean economy transitions. Although Mr. Trump has criticized global climate pledges and national emissions standards, those policies have kept American business competitive internationally. Businesses want certainty and predictability, and many of them have already committed to climate transition action plans, Ms. Kelly says. They're already being pressured by certain European rules and regulations. And so to suddenly have the U.S. jump out of the global arena, it just makes no sense. It's disruptive, unquote. Scores of environmental organizations put out post-election statements criticizing Mr. Trump's prior positions on climate change and urging increased advocacy. Yes, clean energy is good for the economy, many indicated. But addressing climate change is also important for far larger reasons. A changing climate affects everyone, regardless of political affiliation, and what happens over the next 4 years is of profound importance if we are to head off the worst harms of a warming world, Environmental Defense Fund President Fred Krupp and Executive Director Amanda Leland said in a joint statement after the election. The climate crisis requires seriousness and urgency, and it requires holding our government accountable. This fight is about protecting who and what we love, unquote. Still, if clean energy boosters see momentum behind renewable sources, they also say that the policy choices under a new administration will matter. Will Trump slow the growth of clean energy in America and set us back in climate? Probably, but he won't kill it, Mr. Keefe says. If you look at any poll of what people want in clean energy and climate action from the federal government, Republican, Democrat, whatever, they want our country to do more. The momentum is there. The need is there. The technology is there now, and the desire is there. I just hope the new president builds on that and doesn't tear it down, unquote. And that brings us to the conclusion of our reading today. I thank you very much for joining me for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Englewitz. As always, I wish you a most pleasant, safe, and healthy day, and we invite you to please stay tuned for our next regularly scheduled program.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.